Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. The solar wind tonight is 297 kilometers per second, and there are four sunspots on the sun. Two of them are very large clusters. A coronal mass ejection hit Earth's magnetic field today. The impact was weak, lifting the solar wind speed around Earth barely above 300 kilometers per second. Nevertheless, auroras are possible around the Arctic Circle as Earth's magnetic field reverberates from the impact. Ground stations in Norway are picking up disturbances in the geomagnetic field that usually herald northern lights. There are no near-Earth objects closer than 2.8 lunar distances in the next 30 days. Or so they say. Well, tonight we have a controversial program for you, like we never have one, right? But before we get started on that, I want to let you know Mike Adams has a statement out, so I think I'm going to put it on. I quote, "The U.S. government clearly sees the writing on the wall. What lays ahead for America is a day of unbearable reckoning. The financial collapse will wipe out savings accounts, pensions, investment funds, and equities of the working class all across the nation. Imagine bank accounts being reset to zero, bank holidays enforced at gunpoint. That will unleash a wave of violent protests, social chaos, and even talk of revolution. The government will almost certainly respond with the declaration of martial law, the rolling out of highway checkpoints, and before long, the use of live ammo on unruly protesters," close quote. That's not me, that's him. I'm not sure I agree with it. I think that this may be a local thing, maybe a Chicago thing, but I don't think it's going to be nationwide, so I wouldn't worry about that. However, I do recommend a three-step process of securing your finances. Get your disposable income out of the banks. Move it to a safe location, your house, your mother-in-law's house, whatever. Also, if you're in a position to do so, it is recommended by Ann Barnhart, who is one of the premier financial consultants in America. She says cash in your 401k and pay off all your debts except your house. And I recommend buying food storage and silver. And that's exactly why I recommend on my website, xsquaredradio.com, the food investor. My friends Scott Barzee and Danny Morris out in Utah have formed a new company called the Food Investor. It's a new food process with no preservatives. It is very good tasting, stuff like you would prepare in your own kitchen, except it will last for 30 years in the containers in which you receive it. So I highly recommend the Food Investor. Make your move. Many of our listeners already have. No sense eating that MRE peanut butter paste and crackers when you can have something really delicious. I also recommend buying silver. I'm not telling you where to buy yours, but I buy mine from Apmex, APMEX.com. I buy the little 1 ounce silver bars. They fit nicely into a little photo album, and that goes in the library in the house. So you might want to do the same thing. Silver is vastly undervalued right now, somewhere around $38 or $39 an ounce. Should be 10 times that much. Good investment for you. Maybe before we go live into this program, because I have two updates, I want to do a genetically modified foods update. Many of you have been asking for that shortly. And then I want to get into what is now breaking news across the world. In fact, it's so new. It's just now coming out on talk radio. George Nori covered it last night, or maybe it was one of the weekend hosts at C2C, and that is Agenda 21. So we're going to talk about that. But before we do that, let's go ahead and pick up a phone line we already have hanging. Roland, give us an update from California. What's going on?
I don't know. Same old place, different day.
Roland, are you there?
Yeah, so I'll be coming. Hear me.
There you go. Okay, what's going on out in California?
Not much new. Just same old crap, different day. How you doing back there?
We still have wave after wave of mid-sized city bankruptcies looming.
Oh, absolutely. I'm waiting for the entire state to go under.
Yeah, tell me what would happen if that happened. I mean, California at one time was the 11th largest economy in the world by itself, just the state of California. What happens?
Right. At one point, it actually hit number 8.
Wow. So what happens when a state with that much economic power goes bankrupt?
Because I think the situation is Jerry Brown, our governor, here's the best. He's now banned the carry of any weapons, I mean guns or whatever, in public that are unloaded. Okay? This is the complete disarmament of the state. Then on top of that, I'm sure you heard about this. Michelle Obama's wife banned chocolate milk at schools.
I did not know that Michelle Obama had banned flavored milk at school cafeterias.
They are not allowed to have chocolate milk. New Bedford, Massachusetts, it was a CBS report. If you look up chocolate milk banned, Michelle Obama, they banned it at the high school in New Bedford, Massachusetts. The kids were smuggling in chocolate syrup and selling it for 50 cents a squirt.
Well, that's entrepreneurial. I think that's just going too far. Now, I myself am a chocolate lover. You start banning chocolate milk, you've got a serious problem on your hands.
Well, how about this? They banned chocolate milk, and here's the thing. Chocolate dark has antioxidants. They're not sure whether the milk actually blocks the antioxidant in the chocolate. But nevertheless, it's still better for you than fried chicken.
Yeah, I reckon it is. Yeah, I think chocolate is good for
you. They feed the kids fried foods and Spam and everything else, but no chocolate milk. And LA Unified School District also banned it.
So the kids switch over to Pepsi, right?
Yeah, Pepsi, and Spam and fried foods and sugar and, the more sugar they get, the more the diabetes, the more the doctors and hospitals make it a great deal.
Now, I used to bring my own lunch to high school. I rarely ate in the cafeteria. I just didn't I didn't like it. It mostly tasted like hospital food. So I brought my own lunch. Are you still allowed to bring your own lunch from home?
As far as I know, you still can bring your own lunch to school. Let me take a case in point for an example. My friend Nicole, she was eating soup for breakfast. She had no money. Here it is. I put it up on the web. She was an addict since she was born, but she was a speed baby. Both of her kids are speed babies. Now, you're talking to a guy that's willing to take on all that with all the complications involved in that, including her diabetes, where gangrene blister went on her foot, including, any other diseases she may have incurred over her lifetime, because they had her in a syndicate out in Lancaster. And the deal is, her mother, I'm sure, Jackie and Jim, were well aware when she was born at the Honor Days Hospital in Fort Worth, Texas, How is it those doctors and nurses didn't know her mother was addicted to speed?
Well, I have no idea. I mean, all it takes is a simple test.
That
part
of the MK Ultra. And well, also having a woman named Sarah Lynn Fleetwood. That's Mary Fleetwood's ex-wife. She's got a major speed problem with her, or a cocaine or whatever. I mean, once people are addicted to that drug, it's really hard, and the system doesn't have the tools.
I imagine really amphetamines are the most, just about the most addictive drug out there. So, I don't recommend anybody getting started.
Tough to cut. But you're talking to a guy who literally repaired his own kidneys that were perforated by a veterans hospital in Sepulveda, which usually means death. I naturally cured the perforation of my kidneys.
Well, I think that is awesome. I do have a story tonight later on in the second hour about a young man who did similar miraculous healing to himself. But I have to move on with my program, and I got a lot to cover tonight on Agenda 21.
On the world front, I have a question. Are the Germans selling submarines to the Egyptians?
I have no idea. I should check into that. I think the Germans
are selling. I also heard the German people are demonstrating because the welfare program in Germany is in a hurt, and they want the wealthy tax higher in Germany.
Well, and I know they did, in France, I know they did the 75% super tax. How would you like to see that in your neighborhood? But I was not aware they were getting ready to do that in Germany.
My understanding is, it was on the news yesterday, that there was demonstrations in 40 cities in Germany where they were demonstrating because of the welfare crisis over there, with the government funding crisis.
Yeah. I got that. But I think mostly what they're angry about is that German money is going to other countries to help them. And the German people are saying no more.
Well, my understanding was from BBC that the Fed, the Federal Reserve Board, and the Chinese are backing up bonds that the Germans are brokering to the other countries.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. That's exactly what's happening. Bonds are being floated to the tune of between $40 and $80 billion a month.
Right. So they're going to do that. How can it be the German money? The Germans are just brokering that.
Well, I understand, but they may also be underwriting it, which means, you know, they're ultimately liable for the debt if the debtor defaults.
Right, if they're the underwriter, it could mean that. The other thing I heard about, you hear about the deal over there between China and Japan about the island?
Yes. Yes, evidently what happened was there was a private entrepreneur who owned several islands off the coast of Japan. He decided to sell those to the country of Japan. He was paid for those, and now the Chinese are saying, not so fast, those islands belong to us. And so now the Chinese have sent naval ships over there for routine police actions, just to keep a watch on things, and the Japanese are protesting. That's what I've heard.
Right, and because of the Second World War treaty, we have to protect the Japanese, right?
That is absolutely correct. So the interesting thing is that, you know, our enemy becomes our ally. And by the way, it's the same thing with Vietnam. Once we fought Vietnam with the Chinese supporting them, and now we're getting ready to defend Vietnam with the Chinese attacking them. It's kind of interesting.
It's a wacky world, but today, you've got Putin. He's supplying money to the Syrian regime that's in there now, the government. Then you got the U.S. basically, Hillary Clinton, providing money for the rebels. Right?
Yeah, but you got to understand, Syria is really a key to peace in the Middle East. And Assad is a tribal, is tribally legitimate in that position. Right. And
I mean, here's what I'm trying to say. All my friends are in the military. Nobody can seem to understand why they just don't give them all the weapons they want in the Middle East and let them work it out for themselves.
Well, I think common sense belies that. But anyway, Roland, I'd love to get into this. I got 3 hours to go. I got a lot of information I got to cover. I really appreciate the call, though.
Yeah, I was definitely listening to the show. Let's have a great evening.
Thanks, Roland. Bye-bye. Always nice to have the update from California. Stockton, Compton, other cities out there, pension plans pushing them over the edge into bankruptcy, and it's a wave that's sweeping the state. All right, tonight I want to get into a GMO, genetically modified organisms, i.e. food, i.e. Monsanto. I actually tried to find the commitment video from Monsanto, and you'll remember that I played that last year when I did my big GMO expose, and many of you asked me for the 37 pages of show prep notes that I had put together for that night. And I finally found the video on their website. They had taken it down for a few days. However, they have protected it against, taking an excerpt from it. So I'm not able to bring that to you tonight. I'm not going to go around their security measures. And obviously, they're trying to protect themselves from their own statement from being shared with the wrong people. Go figure. I could give you the website and you go listen to it yourself. But this is their commitment to sustainable agriculture. Produce more, conserving more, improving lives. Our vision for sustainable agriculture strives to meet the needs of a growing population to protect and preserve this plant we call home. It should be planet. That's actually misspelled on their own website. And to help improve lives everywhere. In 2008, Monsanto made a commitment to sustainable agriculture, pledging to produce more, conserve more, and improve farmers' lives by 2030. Now, on the producing more, Monsanto works with farmers from around the world to make agriculture more productive and sustainable. Our technologies enable farmers to get more from every acre of farmland. Specifically, we are working to double yields in our core crops by 2030. These yield gains will come from a combination of advanced planting, plant breeding, biotechnology, and improved farm management practices. On the conserving more side, we've strengthened our goal of double crop yields by committing to doing it with one-third fewer resources, such as land, water, and energy per unit produced. We're continuing to develop better seeds and improved on-farm practices that enable farmers to better manage weeds, pests, and environmental stresses, such as drought and things like that. We're working with our partners to develop conservation systems that are better for the planet. And we're working to make these tools of innovation available to the people who have the most direct relationship with the land, the millions of farmers around the world. Under the improving lives portion, the technology we use to develop better seeds and the partnerships we nurture to develop new agronomic practices can drive big increases in yield and productivity. For all the world's farmers who raise themselves from poverty to prosperity, many more people will also prosper through healthier diets, greater educational opportunities, and brighter futures fueled by more robust local economies. As part of the commitment to sustainable agriculture, we set a goal to help farmers improve their quality of life, including 5 million people in resource-poor farm families by 2020. Basically, what has happened is they've introduced their seeds into third world countries, working through all of the trial and error portion. I would call that the clinical tests, actually growing the seeds, feeding animals with the crops and people with the crops, just to see what happened, and then learn lessons from that. And what has happened is some of those foods were taken off the market because of their ill effects on newborns and on farm animals, and then were reintroduced after more genetic changes were made. Some of the effects had to do with bees in the sense that they're Roundup Ready products, although the seeds themselves wouldn't have the marker in them. The flowers, the haploid portion of the plant, did have the marker in it, and the bees in pollinating the flowers would pick up the marker, carry it back to the hive, and that would kill off the hive. And so they took that product off the market and are reworking it to where that marker doesn't appear. In essence, what we have here is a unchecked gateway from the laboratory to the marketplace. Now, you know, many people raise a warning sound when that occurs, when the laboratory and the marketplace are not separated by civilian oversight, stringent testing on non-human subjects, so that we can see what's going to happen if people ingest this, you know, generationally. First with, you know, mice and rats, and then, you know, on to rabbits and pigs and so forth, to very similar physiologies to human physiologies. And it's a sad but a biomedical fact that we do most of the clinical testing with animals before we move to humans. It appears as though some of that process was either shortcutted. That is to say, it went straight from the laboratory with very, you know, cursory testing in the lab, and then straight to the marketplace, and then we saw what the effects were. Or there were effects in the clinical response, that is to say, mice, rats, rabbits, and pigs, and those were either ignored or they were redacted so that the product could go to market anyway. We have evidence, obviously, of both of those occurring. And one, you know, would logically say, how could that possibly happen? And the investigation that we did and others have done, and we've brought that information to you here, is that there's a revolving door between regulation with the FDA, with Congress, and with Monsanto. And that Monsanto is a very large contributor to the campaigns of those who are elected officials and to the budgets of the agencies that oversee this kind of regulation. So what we have is a conflict of interest. And there's so much money in this that it's, you know, and there's so little culpability for each individual office to say, oh, well, we're only signing off on one letter or one test or one waiver or one, you know, set aside. We're not really, you know, looking at the whole picture, but Monsanto is looking at the whole picture. And so it's a comprehensive across-the-board effort with lots of money and lots of lobbying going on in that area. So food derived from authorized genetically modified crops is as safe as conventional non-genetically modified food. That's a statement they make on their website. The first large acreage plantings of GM crops, herbicide-tolerant soybeans and canola, took place in 1996 after successfully passing U.S. regulatory review. This is what I'm talking about. Since then, additional GM crops with herbicide tolerance, insect tolerance, and virus resistance have been given clearance for planting and consumption. These include varieties of corn, sugar beets, squash, papaya. All of these crops have been assessed for food and feed safety in producing countries, and many more countries have approved the import of food or food ingredients that contain GM products. Hundreds of millions of meals containing food from GM crops have been consumed. There has not been a single substantiated instance of illness or harm associated with GM crops. This is on their website. I could spend the rest of the program on substantiated instances of illness and harm associated with GM crops. Sheep, mice, rats, and people. But this is what you read on their website. This is the information that is fed to officials in just about every country where these products are introduced. And if you were to be informed about what actually the genetic modifications are, it might interest you, it might alarm you, but it will inform you that in practically no instance that we can imagine, these particular genetic combinations could occur in nature. For instance, genes from jellyfish, cabbage, are spliced into corn in order to make these organisms insect-resistant, pesticide-resistant, I'm sorry, herbicide-resistant, so that they can use stronger herbicides to knock back the weeds but not kill the plant. That's why they call it Roundup Ready. These Roundup Ready plants, they can spray Roundup on the crop, which ostensibly kills everything that would compete against the plant in the field, but doesn't kill the plant that you want to grow. But that Roundup Ready marker is in itself toxic. So the question was asked, why aren't you running human clinical trials on GM crops? They answer, because existing food crops are recognized as safe. The logical starting point for safety assessment of a GM food is to ask what's different. Aspects of the GM crop, which are the same as the non-GM counterpart, do not require safety assessment. Safety assessment can then be appropriately focused on what is different about the GM crop. All GM crops are analyzed and compared to non-GM counterparts in order to determine whether they have similar concentrations of proteins, carbohydrates, fats, amino acids, fiber, vitamins, and a variety of other components. Two crops which are alike in all respects are said to be substantially equivalent. Now you see how the semantics, we call this scientific semantics, where when we say substantially equivalent, it means a similar thing as you were to go into court to defend a line of computer code which you had originated and which another company had stolen outright. You see your code in their program, and so you exercise your copyright in court and you take them to court. And the judge determines that the code is substantially equivalent. However, there are minor differences in the code here and there, and so there's just enough different that the court is going to determine that they simultaneously developed it and or it doesn't actually infringe upon your patent. However, you see that they both function the same. So when it comes to crops, it's a scientifically semantic statement to say that these two proteins, which you got to understand can be 500,000 molecular weight, are substantially equivalent. But there are minor parts here and there that are different. And we're not going to test them because it's substantially equivalent. That's basically what it's saying. And so they just grow it. It looks the same, it smells the same, it butters up the same, and people consume it. And then they stand back and watch. And they introduce these crops into third world countries. If you don't believe me, go to their website, Monsanto.com, and listen to the About Us video yourself and see where they introduce the crops. Once they are successful there or not, they can make the modifications after a generation or two just to make sure that they don't have the results, because obviously if you test it on a few thousand rats, a few thousand pigs, that's not the same as treating or feeding it to a few million people of various genetic backgrounds. That's a much better incubator, don't you think? So do they. All crops vary in nutrient and other components. No two crops or even the samples of the same crop are identical. It's true. You can grow the same seed in your own garden, your own cabbage, your own corn, your own sugar beets from year to year. And some years you'll have a good crop and some years you won't. Depends on the rain, the sunshine, the day that you plant it, all of that stuff. But there is variety even with the same genetic makeup. So it's easy to say, well, that we didn't have anything to do with that. That was just natural genetic variation. Substantial equivalence is a useful concept which is accepted and utilized by most regulatory agencies worldwide, including the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, the Japanese Ministry of Health and Welfare, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, the World Health Organization, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. However, substantial equivalence is not the end of the assessment process. We still have to address anything that is new or different. Yeah, that's what they actually test. Existing approved GM crops are substantially equivalent to conventional counterparts. The what's new in these crops comes down to the new DNA, which in turn produces a new protein and new RNA encoding that protein. So how do we approach the new DNA, RNA, and proteins? Well, there is no need to test the safety of DNA introduced into GM crops. DNA and resulting RNA, that's the unzipped DNA, by the way, ribonucleic acid, is present in almost all foods, the only exceptions being highly refined materials like oil or sugar from which all cell material has been removed. Thus, DNA is non-toxic, and the presence of DNA in and of itself presents no hazard. Yeah, okay. So it just doesn't make any sense to me. There are a lot of biological poisons that are made of DNA. Then a new protein is introduced into a plant. The safety of that protein does not need to be addressed. It is standard practice to use animals to test any introduced proteins. Animal testing requires very high doses of the test substance be given. In other words, a lot more than you would normally eat. And I will explain to you why this clinical test can be illegitimate in just a second. These levels are, by design, many times higher than those which people would actually consume. Like, you might eat a box of Cheerios in 2 weeks. They eat a box of Cheerios a day. In GM crops and foods derived from them, introduced proteins are usually present only in minute amounts because the levels of protein are so low. It is impossible to test high doses by feeding crops directly to animals. Well, because they won't eat it. They only eat so much. Instead, a purified version of the introduced protein is used in the animal studies. In other words, they concentrate just the protein and feed it to them. The difference between that test and a real live test is that humans are omnivores. We not only eat corn, but we'll eat steak or pork or chicken, or we'll eat butter beans or rice with that corn. We mix foods together. And in pharmaceuticals, we call this drug-drug interaction. It is a marvelously complex industry in which drug salesmen, whether they work for Libby or Pfizer, they're made aware of drug-drug interactions. And so when they go sit down with a doctor or meet with him for 90 seconds in an elevator, which is usually about all the time they have to speak to a doctor about a new drug coming out, that, by the way, is why, it's part of the reason why they run the commercials on TV, so you can ask your doctor about the drug, and the drug salesman doesn't have to do it, and of course they don't have to pay the drug salesman a commission every time the doctor buys it. The other reason is that the commercial on TV and the drug rep will tell the doctor, hey, there's a drug-drug interaction here. If you give this person this drug and they're taking that drug, it can cause these side effects. That's why you hear in the television commercials, if you're taking beta blockers, don't take Viagra because it may cause an unsafe drop in blood pressure. That's why they tell you if you're taking antihistamines, don't take this drug because it can cause, you know, bleeding in mucous membranes or thoughts of suicide. And it was because they've learned that after it went through all the FDA testing and it got out into the marketplace and people mixed it with other stuff. So that's why when these GMO foods come out and, you know, people have allergies to normal foods, what do you think happens when these proteins are introduced into biosystems that have never seen that protein before? Does the biosystem have the enzymes it takes to assimilate that protein, break it down, turn it into useful energy for muscle and energy for that body? The answer is a maybe. Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. Obviously, if it did not, then you'd get just as much nutrition eating milk on sawdust. We call that sterilized, non-nutritive cellulose. You can eat it, you can feel full, but you won't digest it. Why? Because you're not a termite. You don't have the enzymes to break down those proteins. Well, that's a very similar problem with GMO foods. Yes, they're only changing certain things, but it renders the protein unrecognizable by the biosystem, or a new portion of the body recognizes it, a portion that is dormant or hasn't been developed yet or hasn't had an antigen exposed to it yet, and so the body responds differently to it. In rats and mice, it responds with tumors. Different kinds of tissue overgrow. In other words, the physiology of the mouse or rat doesn't look the same anymore because the body, different parts of the body are responding differently to the GMO portions of the food. The same thing happens in humans. The same thing happens in farm animals. And this is the real data that's coming back. And of course, they may be making adjustments, but they're also sweeping the results, which are non-clinical, which are real-world results, under the carpet. And they can do it because they're pouring lots and lots of money into the individuals that are running the agencies. So they say the answer to the what's different question with these crops may include other non-protein components, such as improved fats and oils, improved vitamin content or other exceptions to substantial equivalence. Appropriate safety assessment will need to be carried out for the other new components, but the details will necessarily vary from one to the next. One important consideration will be whether something is new to the human diet or just new to the particular crop. Materials not present in the diet may require extensive assessment. In contrast, a nutrient with a long history of safe use and limited toxicity, such as beta-carotene, may require little additional assessment. There is no need for or value in testing the safety of GM foods in humans, so long as the introduced protein is determined safe. Food from GM crops determined to be substantially equivalent is not expected to pose any health risks. And I put in italics, not expected to pose. Further, it is impossible to design a long-term safety test in humans, which would require, for example, intake of large amounts of a particular GM product over a large portion of the human lifespan. There is simply no practical way to learn anything via human studies of whole foods. That is why no existing food, conventional or GM, or food ingredient additive has been subjected to this type of testing. Well, that's true, but the testing that we end up doing is the real-world testing. In other words, we put it into the gut of the populace, and then we do a statistical analysis of the results. What part per million gets cancer? What part per million lives longer? What part per million ends up with various organ failures or, you know, Alzheimer's or MS or different diseases, which we still are working on a cure for because we really don't know what's causing them. However, we do see an upward trend of their occurrence. And It's quite possible that by the time we connect the dots in the general populace, there are no virgin seeds left, that every plant on the planet has been cross-pollinated with these GM foods. In other words, the flora has changed on the planet, and now the fauna has to catch up. So normally what happens in any biosystem is a process called natural selection. Those organisms that can survive or can prosper or have some reproductive advantage, we call it in science, to the change in the flora will prosper in the society, and those who do not will die off. And so essentially what has happened is that genetic modification may have started in the corn, it may have started in the sugar beets or the soybeans, but it has progressed up the food chain to the human being. And although it's academic for Monsanto to say on their website it's impossible to conduct these tests, it would just take too long, it would take too much money, we couldn't possibly conduct a commercial enterprise if we had to wait that long for the results, the true results are that the race that's feeding off that food will change. There is absolutely no question about it. The real mystery, and it may be the real gamble, it's a little like, you know, pressing the button on a new weapon when you don't really know what it will do. Theoretically, you know, but it's so devastating you've never actually tried it before. You're pressing the button on a genetic avalanche that doesn't cascade down, it cascades up the food chain. Each protein which assimilates the previous protein becomes more and more complex, becomes more and more altered based on foreign DNA, foreign RNA that is spliced in a recombinant manner, an unnatural manner, into that DNA and RNA, those proteins that result from those genetic molecules are different. They're different than anything the body has ever seen before. And it's one thing to say, yeah, we tested it on 100 generations of rats at 100 times the concentration. But did you feed the rats to wolves and then watch 100 generations of wolves to see what happened? No. So that's where the difference is. Somebody asked, are you testing for cancer? Genetically modified plants generally contain only a limited number of new components. I don't really know what limited means. Not present in conventional varieties of the same crop. These components are defined specifically by the modification made. DNA, let's see if I can say they're not repeating themselves here. Certain protein hormones or toxins may have the potential to influence cancer rates as a result of their specific biological activity. However, such biological activity is predictable from protein structure and will be easily recognized in acute toxicology studies. Proteins that could cause cancer are not used in GM plants. Well, yes, that's true. Proteins that are known to cause cancer are not spliced into GM plants, but you've got to understand the difference between acute toxicology and chronic toxicology. Acute toxicology is you ate it and you got sick, or you ate it and you had an immediate response to it, hives or a rash or blindness or, you know, an erection that lasts for 4 hours, whatever. That's an acute response. A chronic response is that you ate it and your children ate it and their children ate it, and now we're beginning to see that all three generations, and we should have seen it back with the grandparents, we missed it with the parents, and now we're seeing it in the children. But guess what? Now it's too late, because now it has become part of the genetics of the child. And whether the child ever eats another corn dog or not with that genetic marker, it is in their DNA now. It is part of their genetic structure, and they will hand it on to their children. And so when we talk about drug-drug interactions, we talk about food-food interactions. We haven't even begun to talk about the complexity of genetic interactions. What happens if two individuals who have been eating GMO foods marry or have children, and then we see the interaction? You see, we've had hundreds of thousands of generations, if we really believe man's been on this earth for more than 50,000 years, more than 50 million years, we've had hundreds of thousands of generations of genetic combinations between haploid sperms and eggs to create diploid human beings. All of the variables have been worked out, and the ones that didn't survive, didn't survive. Now, in these latter days, we can give drugs to those who in, you know, years past, generations past, say 200 years ago, would not have survived. Diabetics, asthmatics, you know, those with leukemia, they would not have survived to reproduce. Now we have drugs and treatments to allow those individuals, because they are human beings, great spiritual beings in many cases, living inside of those defective biological transducers, but they're living quasi-normal lives because they're supported by those things that their bodies don't make, whether they're neurological or whether they're other forms of physiological assistance. Now they're able to live normal lives. They're able to have offspring, and so those genetic markers are being inherited by the next generation. And in some cases, you know, like is attracted to like, and now some of those genetic traits are becoming dominant, which even if they marry someone and have children with someone who doesn't have the marker still shows up. It means it's a dominant gene. So this is how complex the genetic picture gets and why it is so amazing that this kind of thinking, this kind of ethics has not been applied to the GMO industry. Another question. I have heard that the increasing allergenicity rate is linked to GM crops introduction. Is that true? There is no evidence to link allergenicity to currently authorized GM crops. I want you to listen to that sentence very carefully. Let's just take out allergenicity because it's probably self-explanatory. There's no evidence to link allergic reactions to currently authorized GM crops. That's also legal semantics, legal and scientific semantics. It's not saying that there is no link. It's saying there's no evidence to link. It's sort of like, you know, the bank robber being accused of robbing the bank. And he says, there's no evidence linking me to that bank robbery. That's not saying, you didn't say you didn't rob the bank. You didn't commit perjury because you didn't say you didn't rob the bank. You said there's no evidence linking you to the bank robbery. That means we haven't found it yet. That means that you have buried it well enough, or you killed the witness. Well, that makes a lot of sense in this case, and I'm going to cover that a little bit more. We got started late. Let's go ahead and get our first break out of the way, and we'll be back with the second hour of X Squared Radio. And please don't go away, because we're going to cover Agenda 21 tonight. There is no way I could cover this in a three-hour program, and I wanted to do this GMO update because many of you have been asking for it. So I'm not just going to do it on this program. We're going to maybe take a month of October, and we will work on this Agenda 21 with you. This is so powerful. This is so amazing. And when you find out who is behind this, you're going to be absolutely amazed. I promise you, no one has discussed this with you. We'll be right back. Give me 5 minutes.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers or split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying.
Past life regression.
Okay, welcome back to X Squared Radio. Sorry about that. I hit my iPad to light up the screen again and change to another track. Sorry about that. That's the wonder of live radio. We just love it. Anything can happen, and you get to experience it with us, which is kind of cool. So let me cover a couple of quick things. First of all, as you're putting together your Christmas presents this year, I want you to put something that will really, really make a difference, especially in your kids and your grandkids. It's an investment. Yeah, it's an investment in the future. It's an investment in the security of the future. I'm recommending that you go to the Food Investor. Go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the Food Investor banner, and buy your kids or your grandkids or your kids that have grandkids so they can take care of them. Buy them a 72-hour kit, a special X Squared Radio 72-hour kit. This is food. Of course, they can eat it, you know, as a regular meal if they want to. But this is food that will last for 30 years in the container in which it's received. You can put it into a backpack, put it into a cooler or a box somewhere marked so that if you ever have to hightail it out, for whatever reason, you gotta get out of town because of a natural disaster, because of a flood, a tornado, a fire, a hurricane, or some other emergency that might come up. You don't want to be a burden on FEMA. You don't want to be stuck in one of their soup lines, not able to get to your loved ones or take care of yourself the way you want to. Unless you go to the Food Investor and buy the gift that really shows that you care about them. I'm just saying, put those expensive electronics aside for this holiday season, okay? Trust me, they'll be there. In fact, they'll be even better if you just wait. But get this out of the way first. Go to the Food Investor and buy your kids and grandkids or yourself a little security. Tasty security. The Food Investor. My friends Scott Barzee and Danny Morris in Utah will greatly appreciate it. Also, a couple of things coming up. This weekend, I'm going to be at the Conscious Life Expo at the Hilton in Santa Monica. Go to the banner there at X Squared Radio. Click on that. Get registered. If you've already bought a book from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, or wherever, and you didn't get it autographed, bring it by. I'll sign it. No problem. Love to meet you. I am giving a workshop on remembering the future, the physics of the soul and time travel at the Conscious Life Expo, and I want to see you there. So come down, get registered. It's affordable. You don't have to drive if you live in, or fly if you live in Southern California. The weather is going to be great. Take a break. Come on down and see me. The following weekend, I'm going to be in Southern Indiana at the Pythagoras conference. 50 speakers there from all over the world. Sam Osmanagic and, oh my goodness, so many, even royalty is going to be there speaking to us. This is Sandra Sabatini's first really large conference, and it's in the Midwest. Can you get that? We never have these kinds of conferences in the Midwest. They're always out on the West Coast, or they're always over in Europe somewhere. This is one almost everybody that listens to this program in the U.S. can drive to. It's right smack in the middle of 73% of the population of the country. Come and see us over there. It starts Thursday and goes all the way to Sunday, and there are workshops on Monday if you want to stay. I promise it'll be a life-changing event. So those are three things that I want you to take care of. And if you're in Europe listening to this, on I believe it is the 10th of November. No, I'm sorry, the 14th of November. We're going to be at the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. It's just outside of Amsterdam. You can go to Breakthrough Energy Movement, or you can go to xsquaredradio.com. I will put the banner up there tonight so that you can access it. We're going to not only have some breakthrough energy technology there from Searle, John Searle's group, and others. So you really want to see what's going to happen in the field of innovative energy production or conservation or conversion. But I also want you to attend because I've been invited to give a two-hour keynote speech on the future of energy in the world. And I'm going to be discussing not only the electric vehicles, but I'm also going to be discussing what government needs to do, what citizens need to do, all the way down to the city council level, and how we can really make a global difference, a radical, disruptive global difference in the way we generate and use and conserve energy. So I encourage you to attend that if you're in Europe. If not, it's just a 6.5 hour flight to Amsterdam, and we'd love to see you over there. Let me go ahead and finish up the GMO segment that I have tonight, because the idea that there are allergic reactions to these crops is probably the most alarming evidence that we have coming to us from around the world, different emails that come to us, different links that people send us from around the world, around the country, what's going on. We know that wheat has recently been approved. I know the wheat belt very, very well up in northern Washington, eastern Washington state, east of Spokane. I can tell you that there are millions and millions of acres of wheat up there that have been growing up there for hundreds of years. It feeds the world. It overfeeds the world all the wheat that it needs. Russia also has wheat. And there are individuals that are growing wheat up there that is grown from seeds found in the wheat vaults of ancient Egypt. That's correct. It's a much larger, much more robust, much more prolific wheat than what we grow today, the hard red winter wheat. And there are individuals in Washington state that are growing it. There are farmers up there that are growing in non-plowed fields. This is a kind of the old way of planting wheat, but now it's the new way of planting wheat. Many farmers that are doing this, one of the individuals up there has been written up many, many times and in globally published magazines. His name is Fred Fleming. He's a huge innovator in organic wheat growing, and his wheat is used in all kinds of breads all around the world, and just a fantastic individual and a real pioneer. He says he's a recovering farmer. So this kind of innovation has been going on up there, and it's really making a difference. And many farmers are now rotating again canola back into their wheat crops every fourth year. The taproot goes down really deep, breaks up the soil, adds some nutrients back to the soil that wheat depletes from the soil. The insects that grow on canola eat the insects that grow on wheat, so it really creates a great biosystem for the wheat growers up there. And the economics hasn't worked out so well for them because the only place to sell canola is to the mills in Canada. And Canada doesn't pay them enough to pay for the transportation. So in order to grow canola, they actually have to count it as a year of loss and absorb it in the other 3 years of growing wheat. So some of the wheat farmers, in order to trim their economics, will grow wheat for 4, 5, 6, even 7 years before rotating in canola. Now, you know and I know what happens to soil if you grow one crop, like corn on corn on corn on corn, or wheat on wheat on wheat on wheat. You begin to deplete the soil irreparably. We don't want that to happen to the wheat land of America. We want them to rotate in the canola, and we want them to make it profitable. That's why we designed and built a biodiesel plant up there that crushes canola seed and turns it into diesel fuel and takes the meal from the canola and generates a high-protein, medium-fat meal, which sells for several hundred dollars a ton, which can be used to feed cows. It's not the hexane-stripped canola that you get in the commercial biodiesel plants. This leaves about 7% of the fat in the seed and only extracts the oil that will come out through crushing. That oil is then converted into biodiesel, which feeds the very farm equipment that turns around and plows the fields and works the fields of the wheat. So it's a very, very good not only biosystem but ecosystem for them, and it works. And that model will work anywhere in the world, if you follow that model. If you have any questions about how to make that work, give me a call, drop me a letter. I'd be happy to share that with you and show you how to put that together. It's way less expensive than the commercial biodiesel plants. It also produces about 2 to 3 times more biodiesel fuel than the soybean units, because these fields typically from canola or camelina seed produce between 140 and 160 gallons per acre. Soy only produces between 30 and 40 gallons per acre. So plus you see that the price of soybeans go skyrocketing because the bean itself is used for human food, the protein. And so once that happens, then it becomes unfeasible to make fuel out of because the oil costs too much. But canola is quite stable. Biggest cost in it is the alcohol that it takes to make the transesterification process, and even that can be made from cellulosic sources, greatly bringing the cost down. Now, let me get back to this, because the reason that I brought this up is that this genetically engineered wheat tried to get into that market. They found some problems with it, so they pulled it back off the market, and now it's back in the market. And I hate to see it because it's going to sneak into Cheerios and, you know, wheat checks and bread before you know it, and hopefully we get some labeling guidelines so that if any part of the food is GMO, that has to be made known to the public. There is evidence to suggest that the reporting of allergies is increasing in some countries and geographic areas. Monsanto claims this is likely due to several causes. We call this dilution when it comes to pointing blame at a specific process. In politics, we call it blaming. There has been an increased interest in food allergies. Unfortunately, there are no stable diagnostic criteria for testing for food allergies and food intolerance. Together, these two factors have probably resulted in an increase in reporting of allergies. Therefore, rates of allergies may not have actually increased as much as it would appear. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Sounds very, very familiar. Increased prevalence of allergies is, in some cases, well documented. These are likely due to the fact that the consumption of some foods has increased in certain geographic areas. For instance, in the U.S., the use of soy-based infant formula has increased in the last 10 to 20 years. It has increased, but it didn't start that late. I fed my kids that stuff too. You need to be exposed to a substance in order to develop an allergy to it, and historically not as many people had been exposed to soy particularly as infants, as they are today, any increase in infant soy allergies is likely due to increased consumption of soy. There is also evidence that better household hygiene and reduced early exposure to allergies and infections may be partially responsible for increasing rates of some allergies. What this basically means is if a child is not exposed to an antigen early on, they won't develop a resistance to it. And if they're exposed to it later, which doesn't allow them to develop a resistance to it early on, then they develop an allergic reaction to it or a sensitivity to it. It's been called the hygiene hypothesis because exposure to certain allergens is removed or greatly reduced during infancy and early childhood. The immune systems may develop an improper or exaggerated response. We call this a histamine response, where the mucous membranes start pouring liquid in a response to try to flush away the allergen. And so we take antihistamines to block the histamine reaction. Another portion of the histamine reaction is a reddening of the skin. It raises the temperature of the skin, which is a natural biological way of killing off a virus by changing the temperature, or forcing white blood cells to go to a much more well-vascularized skin, which we call redness, in order to capture the infection and take it away. We call that pus. So that's the kind of allergic reactions that you can get. We just take drugs to block it because we don't want the reaction. So we're still exposed to the allergen. Supporting evidence for this theory includes the fact that children on farms have lower rates of asthma than non-farm children, and children born into a household with a pet are also less likely to develop asthma than children in a home where a pet is introduced later in life. It's true, because there is a biological timing. Just like when a fetus is developing in the womb, certain things are developed at certain times, and if the mother is not fed well or she has some stress in her life during that period of development of the infant, it will show up in the infant. By the way, one of the last things to develop in a fetus are the lungs. So premature babies almost always have pulmonary problems. Assessing the allergenicity of introduced proteins is a required component of the safety assessment of GM crops. There is no single test that can be used to determine if a substance is an allergen. Consequently, allergenicity must be assessed on a case-by-case basis. Well, it's generally Felder-Garb, because it can be tested. It just takes a lot of money and a lot of time, and there are a lot of regulations that the FDA puts in place to make you go through a regimen once you start that testing. People don't want to start it because it's a very slow, very tedious, very paper-rich process. Another question people ask, and this is a big one, are GM crops associated with the early onset of puberty? I'm not the only one to have noticed that they lowered the age of puberty. Just go to your local junior high. It won't take you long to figure it out. While there is evidence that girls are experiencing the onset of puberty at a younger age than they have in the past, there is no evidence to suggest that GM crops are involved. Most experts believe this is a result of improved nutrition. Would that be 4 out of 5 dentists? I'm not sure what they mean by experts. There are 3 basic bodies of evidence to support this statement. First, millions of tons of GM crops have been fed to farm animals for more than a decade. There is no evidence of early onset of puberty in farm animals. Does that make sense to you? I mean, the sentence makes sense, but the result doesn't make sense. You're not going to see a result in the first generation of consumers. Just like if you were to feed your grass some nutrients and then feed your goats on the grass, you're not going to see a change in the goats, but you may see a change in the animal that's eating the goats. Because what happens is these toxins, these changes, accumulate as you go up the genetic ladder. The same thing happens in fish. Yeah, it's easy to say, well, these fish don't have any higher content of mercury than any other fish, or at least it's not past the danger limit. Well, no, but the fish only live one generation. The fish that eats the fish is what you should test. The human that eats the fish, lots of fish, is what you should test, because there you will see the toxins, the pathogens, the heavy metals, the genetic changes. You'll see them accumulate there. And then if you take the offspring of the being that eats the fish, you'll see the next generation of changes. Second, studies with GM crops and laboratory animals also have failed to show any association between GM foods and early onset of puberty or other unexpected hormonal effects. We have to say unexpected because all soybeans naturally contain phytoestrogens. Finally, the advancing age of puberty is a phenomenon that predates the introduction of GM crops and which has occurred in most developed nations despite the fact that GM use varies widely. Well, that's probably the most legitimate statement in the entire cadre there. Just don't see. I see at least semantic and legal and scientific arguments and everything else that they've said on their website. I personally believe that introducing genes into GM crops that aren't, that won't possibly naturally occur there, is spinning the breech of a gun with at least one round in the breech. Sooner or later, one's going to end up in the chamber. The odds are there, slim, but there. Now, I'm not the only one that feels this way. In fact, there are countries that feel this way. There are states that feel this way. California has recently passed a regimen of regulations, and there are some on the ballot this year, to at least force GMO products to be included in the labeling on foods, especially prepared foods like cereal or soups or stuff like that. Does this have a GMO bean in it? Does this have a GMO corn in it? Does this have GMO sugar beets in the syrup? I mean, this is what we want to know. And they're pushing for it in California, and I believe it's going to pass. But there are countries also. You know, Russia has suspended GMO corn imports. This is just brand new. It was just a few days ago. Russia's consumer rights watchdog said Tuesday, I wish I could say the name, but I can't, is Rospotrebnadzor. Okay? Don't make me say it again. Said Tuesday it has suspended the import and use of genetically modified corn made by Monsanto following a study's allegations that the crop causes cancer. This organization said the country's Institute of Nutrition has been asked to assess the validity of the study, while the European Commission's Directorate General for Health and Consumers has also been contacted to explain the European Union's position. The study, conducted by the University of Cannes in France, alleged that rats fed over a two-year period with the U.S. chemical company's genetically modified NK603 corn. So if you're out driving around your county when a new crop of corn comes up, they always post the sign of what breed of corn is in that field. Look for that, NK603. Developed more tumors and other severe diseases than a test group fed with regular corn. The study also alleged that rats fed with NK603 and exposed to Monsanto's Roundup weed killer suffered from more pathologies than the test group. Last week, Monsanto said it did not think the French study would affect its license to export NK603 to Europe, but would wait to hear from the European Food Safety Authority, or EFSA, which has been asked by European Commission to also look into the research. Quote, based on our initial review, we do not believe the study presents the information that would justify any change in EFSA's views on the safety of genetically modified corn products or alter their approved status for genetically modified imports, close quote. However, the French author defended his stance on GMO corn. This comes out of Reuters in Brussels. The French author of a study linking a type of genetically modified corn to higher health risks in rats dismissed criticism of his research methods on Thursday. This is 2 days after this report came out, describing the work as the most detailed study to date on the subject. Gilles Eric Seralini of the University of Cannes and colleagues said on Wednesday that rats fed on Monsanto's genetically modified corn or exposed to its top-selling weed killer suffered tumors and multiple organ damage and premature death. How would you like to see that on the byproducts of an Ask Your Doctor commercial? But experts not involved with the study were skeptical, describing the French team's statistical methods as unconventional and accusing them of going on a statistical fishing trip. Speaking at a news conference in Brussels on Thursday, Seralini defended the peer-reviewed study, which was published in the journal Food and Chemical Toxicology. This study has been evaluated by the world's best food toxicology magazine, which took more time than people who reacted within 24 hours without reading the study, he told Reuters Television. I'm waiting for criticism from scientists who have already published material in journals on the effects of GMOs and pesticides on health in order to debate fairly with peers who are real scientists and not lobbyists. Earlier, the European Commission said it had asked the EU's Food Safety Authority, EFSA, to verify the results of the French study and the report and report their findings. Quote, EFSA's mandate is to verify what this group of scientists has presented, to look at their research conditions, look at how the animals were treated, quote, close quote. And this is the health spokesman commission, Frederick Vincent, told this to a news briefing, which when it is a health spokesman, he's probably a lobbyist. We hope that by the end of the year, we will have an EFSA opinion on this piece of scientific research. In 2003, EFSA published a safety assessment of the GM corn variety known as NK603, which is tolerant to Monsanto's Roundup weed killer. The assessment concluded that NK603 was as safe as non-GM corn, after which the European Union granted approval for its use in food and feed. Seralini said EFSA's assessments were less rigorous than his team's study. I reckon so. He says, GMOs have been evaluated in an extremely poor and lax way, with much less analysis than we have done. It's the world's most detailed and longest study. 2 years? 2 years is the world's longest study? I'm worried. Therefore, some people are responsible and guilty of authorizing this GMO only after 3 months, he said. Well, there you are. On the 19th, just 11 days ago, it was also reported rats fed a lifetime diet of Monsanto's genetically modified corn or exposed to its top-selling weed killer Roundup did suffer tumors. This is an independent paper. Protesters set sights on GMOs and they closed the California facilities. This happened 18 days ago. Opponents of genetically engineered foods on Wednesday, that would be September 12th, not this last Wednesday, blocked shipments and deliveries at Monsanto Company's vegetable seed company in California that developed a new genetically modified sweet corn that will hit stores this fall. The protesters, who want to remove all so-called genetically modified organisms from the food supply, say their action is a preview of about 6 other events planned for countries around the world next week. They also hope to drum up support for a California ballot measure that would require food sellers to label a broad range of products, including soup, soy milk, breakfast cereals, chips, etc., just as I had said earlier. I'm skipping down through here because I really want to get to this Agenda 21 stuff tonight. So it is right at the bottom of the hour. We have roughly an hour and a half left in the program. I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines because some of you out there already know about Agenda 21. And if you don't, you're going to, because in the next 90 minutes, prepare to have your mind totally blown. I know that I'm going to reveal stuff to you here tonight. You don't know about it. If you're serving on a city council or you're serving in a legislature somewhere in this country, some state, some county, some city, you need to listen to what I'm about to tell you. Because I'm going to share with you a six-minute audio from the video of a young man who made a presentation in Austin, Texas, to a city council who was going to enact, who did, in fact, enact a section of the Agenda 21, and they didn't even know what it was. Phone number is 888-429-5471. If you want to listen on 888-429-5471. If you miss that number, you can go to xsquaredradio.com or pbsradio.com, channel 2, and the number is posted there. If you're listening on the conference line, it's easy to hang up and call in if you want to. The conference line number is 760-569-7676, and the passcode is 192919#. Or if you have a Droid phone, you can go to xsquaredradio.com and you can click on the Droid app on the left-hand side. I wrote a Droid app. So you just click on that, download it to your phone, and you are one click away from listening to this program. Now, Agenda 21. My good friend Richard Shaw, an award-winning filmmaker in Hollywood, wrote me this week and let me know something that put me on a trail that leads me from the Monsanto takeover of the world's food supply on land to an organization that is very quickly taking control of the world's food supply in the sea. What I am about to share with you is first a statement made in an Austin City Council meeting by a young man named John Bush. No relation. He's a little nervous, but you listen closely to this 6 minutes, and then I'll reveal more of the agenda to you. Get ready to have your mind blown. Oops. Get ready to have a delay. I have to open this now in my Windows Media Player because for some reason my link did not work. So I'm going to go to my Windows Media Player. Just give me 1 second here. This young man was so impressive to me because what he did is he went into the city council just to inform the mayor and the city council members what they were about to pass. I think they were unaware because, you know, if you go to the website and let's see if this is it. No, this is not it. Here we go. All right, so if you look at what the website does, it shows lots of wonderful, beautiful pictures. Just, you know, stuff that would make Jacques Cousteau jealous. The best stuff you'd ever want to see. Of course we want to take care of the oceans. There's no way we want to do anything that would jeopardize our oceans. But this is an agenda that will blow your mind. 7 minutes, 40 seconds, here we go. Okay, there's a little bit of text here in the middle of it. So then John Bush is going to talk. He's speaking to the mayor. He has been granted a little bit of time to speak, and so he is about to reveal what he knows about this piece of legislation that they're about to pass.
John Bush had signed up wishing to give us testimony. Mr. Bush here, welcome, John. Let's see, and is that Sharon Blythe by chance? Hey, Sharon, welcome. So she has donated her 3 minutes to you, John, so you'll have up to 6 minutes if you need it. Welcome.
Thanks, Council. My name is John Bush. I'm speaking on behalf of Texans for Accountable Government. It's a newly formed political action committee. I'm going to give a little history lesson about how this point-of-sale ordinance, is there an actual name for it now? What should I call it?
Well, I think it's generally referred to as our energy efficiency upgrades.
Okay. The energy efficiency upgrade, that sounds better, ordinance. A little history lesson on how that ties in with something called Agenda 21, which is a United Nations program from 1992 on sustainable development. If the links I'm about to present allude to thoughts of international conspiracies, that's okay. They're supposed to. You see, when the Austin City Council approves the energy efficiency upgrade resolution, it will be one further step in the culmination of a long chain of events, policy papers, closed-door meetings, international agreements, and all-around chicanery that began many years ago. Before carbon was thought of as the most evil thing in the world, there were individuals who I'm referred to as internationalists hashing out a plan to further their scheme for world government through the means of excessive environmentalism. Let's trace the path of what eventually would become the Energy Efficiency Upgrade Ordinance. Believe me, it's worth noting where all this is coming from, because there's many other ordinances and environmental action that the City Council will be taking in the near future. Agenda 21 was revealed at the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, or the Earth Summit, which was held in Rio de Janeiro on June 14, 1992. Agenda 21 defines itself as a comprehensive plan of action to be taken globally, nationally, and locally by organizations of the United Nations system in order to further the agenda of sustainable development. This is actually where we get the term sustainable development from Agenda 21. Amongst the stated objectives of Agenda 21 is the rewilding of America through the Wildlands Project. This project would remove human beings from over half of the land in America and deem these areas core wilderness zones. Regardless of where your family farm once was, human beings will not be allowed to set foot in these areas. There would also be highly controlled and monitored buffer zones around these areas in which travel would be severely limited. Finally, humans would be forced to live in compact, futuristic cities full of skyscrapers where travel is controlled and tracked. This is what the eventual culmination of smart growth is going to look like. It sounds crazy, I know. I was just as dubious when I first heard about it, too. However, upon reading their own documents, it turns out that it's all true. It's called the Wildlands Project, part of Agenda 21. I suggest you all look into it in detail because you're about to pass an ordinance that's beginning the process. The point of sale ordinance is part of the Austin climate, What I thought was really crazy, however, is that the mayor's climate protection program is furthering the implementation of Agenda 21 here in Austin, and we're about to vote on it here. So here's the connection between the point of sale ordinance and Agenda 21. Very interesting stuff. And again, I highly recommend reading Agenda 21. The point of sale ordinance is part of the Austin climate protection program. Mayor Nguyen didn't just come up with this wonderful plan off the top of his head. It's Austin's version of the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, which came out of the U.S. Conference on Mayor's Climate Protection Summit on February 2005. The summit was hosted and funded by the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, a United Nations organization. Funded by tax-exempt institutions such as the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation, the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives is the primary group that has been driving the implementation of Agenda 21 at the local level. And this is from Agenda 21, Chapter 28. Because so many of the problems and solutions being addressed by Agenda 21 have their roots in local activities, the participation and cooperation of local authorities will be a determining factor in fulfilling its objectives. So basically, many of the tenants in the mayor's or the Austin Climate Protection Program have their origins in Agenda 21, which I see as a globalist push to use environmentalism as a means of global control. It sounds like an Orwellian conspiracy theory, I know. It's funny because we now have a regional secretariat of the United Nations for the International Council on Local Environmental Initiatives, and it's called the ICLEI Oceania. And that's, of course, the name for one of the regional bodies in 1984. Now, I know it's kind of creepy that the aspects of a suppressed 1992 UN document, which if executed would greatly diminish the national sovereignty of the United States, are being voted on right here, right now. But I also feel that the prospect of government punishing its citizens if they do not complete a mandatory audit and disclose all historic energy use to the city, the buyer, and eventually to an international body. This is how it starts, slowly but surely. It sounds like a good thing, but now we're pretty soon we'll be giving up even more of our sovereignty. I believe that this violates the core essence of private property, which is a major tenet that this country was founded upon. Also, it seems to be the sentiment of some on the council that if these measures, they could potentially become mandatory if voluntarism does not work. The group I represent and myself are greatly opposed not only to the prospect of mandatory upgrades, but the audit to the mandatory audit itself. We see this measure as the essence of government, both local and in the future international, as intruding on the free market and an intrinsic right to private property. This begins at the local level, but as we see, localism then turns to state or national regulation, and in the not-so-distant future with the push for globalism, this will be governed by an international body as part of the United Nations through Agenda 21. I know it sounds crazy again, but this is all fact, everything that I've stated. It is for these reasons and many more that Texans for Accountable Government is opposed to the point-of-sale ordinance or the energy efficiency upgrade ordinance. And I hope that you guys will actually read Agenda 21, because many of the things that you're going to be implementing in the future are directly a result of Agenda 21. Thank you.
Now listen very closely.
Thank you, Mr. Bush. So again, we have a motion and a second on the table approving combined items 47 and 48. Further comments? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion passes on a vote of 7-0. Thank you all very much.
And that is how it's done. So if you're not attending your city council meetings, you deserve what you get. Bravo, John Bush, for attending your city council meeting and for entering in your political action committee's statement into the record. Now, I'm curious, like you, because we're Earth explorers, who is Oceana? Well, I knew you would ask that as well, so I went to their website, and I learned what they are about. As I always do, I want to share with you their statement about themselves. This is what they do. Now, you can go to oceana.org, and you can listen to this yourself, because there are lots of superb video shots of sea life, as I said, that would make Jacques Cousteau jealous. There's some music to make you feel great. But I want you to listen to the words. Listen to their mission. All right, hang on 1 second while I open this up for you. This is Oceana. And I want you to pay close attention, and then I'm going to key in on some things, and you'll learn about it. Here we go. There's some text here in the beginning that shows some ordinances. You hear some ocean waves and imagine sea turtles swimming unfettered and beautiful pictures of reef photography, all in amazing filtered color.
Our blue planet is at a crossroads. Soon there will be 9 billion of us to support. Where will all the food and resources that we need come from? There is a last refuge. One place to turn for wild, unfettered beauty, abundance, and diversity. It's under the waves. Down deep into the sea, into the depths of our oceans.
Very well produced video. Jeff Goldblum is the guy
oceans are the source of all life on our planet. Here we find the potential for unimaginable renewable abundance. Over a billion people, including some of the poorest in the world, depend on our oceans and wild seafood for survival. This incredible bounty is in danger. Every day, we're taking out so much more than our oceans can reproduce. The spectacular wildlife of the deep is being hunted with military precision, wreaking havoc upon the balance of the oceans, which has taken hundreds of millions of years to perfect. Millions of sharks are finned. Millions of tons of seafood are caught and then thrown away. Ocean nurseries, the breeding grounds for new life, are being destroyed every day, indiscriminately. We are sabotaging ourselves and our children's future, throwing away one of our greatest sources of strength and renewal, draining our world's oceans of life, just when we need them the most to feed our hungry planet. Our oceans are amazingly resilient. Sea life can reproduce quickly. It's not too late. We can turn the tide of destruction around. The sea is not ungoverned. Just 10 countries control most of the world's wild catch. Oceania has won key policy victories in many of these countries, protecting over 1 million square miles of ocean. And we can do this around the world. We know it works. We need to focus on 3 goals: stop overfishing, control bycatch, and protect the nurseries. With your help, we can restore the ocean's vitality. We can have oceans that provides 700 million meals a day. Let's honor the original source of life for our planet and ensure that it remains bountiful and beautiful for generations to come. Help us. Let's save the oceans and feed the world.
Sounds very noble, doesn't it? Do you realize that seizing 1 million square miles of ocean, what that means? That means that some policy has to be put in place. Some force has to be put in place. That somehow that this group, Oceania, can control the oceans and preserve everything for us. Now, you also heard another organization, the ICLEI. Now, it's not an acronym. I don't really know what it means. It doesn't say on their website. Local Governments for Sustainability is the world's leading association of cities and local governments dedicated to sustainable development. You just heard the mayor of the Austin City Council pass one of these ordinances with no opposition from his own council. ICLEI is a powerful movement of 12 megacities, 100 super cities, and urban regions, 450 large cities, as well as 450 small and medium-sized cities and towns in 84 countries. ICLEI promotes local action for global sustainability. You just heard Austin City Council take local action and supports cities to become sustainable, resilient, resource efficient, biodiverse, low carbon, to build a smart infrastructure and to develop an inclusive green urban economy. The ultimate aim is to achieve healthy and happy communities. We have developed stable long-term programs to support local-level sustainability and continue to develop innovative new programs to respond to issues of international concern. Now, I know you think these words are wonderful, but I can tell you, as the CEO of a company that is in the green business, that there's no money for green business coming from these organizations. They only consume money. They only put regulations in place. They only restrict use and access to resources. They don't give resources out. They're no more concerned with replacing gas-powered vehicles with electric vehicles than they would be in opening the vaults with all their money in it and giving it away to the poor. Now, after a long battle by Oceania and allies, a planned coal-fired thermoelectric power plant in northern Chile known as Castilla was rejected by the Chilean Supreme Court. The Castilla plant was planned for the Punta Cajos region, just a few kilometers from important habitats for Humboldt penguins, sea turtles, and one of Chile's few seagrass meadows. As part of its operations, the plant would have released warm water into the ocean, which could have affected the entire ecosystem. It's true. It would have. I personally have fished off Redondo Beach, which has exactly the same kind of plant there, releasing warm water into the bay. As you know, the Pacific Ocean is quite a bit cooler than the Atlantic Ocean. And so, consequently, the sea life that grows there is quite a bit different. But when you raise the temperature of the ocean 2 or 3 degrees, sea life begins to proliferate. Did you know that this area of Southern California has the highest bonita population on the coast? It makes for great fishing. It's a species of tuna. So it does affect the ecosystem. But affect and destroy are two different things. Now, the EU voted in favor of strictly protecting 10 threatened species of sharks and rays in the Mediterranean Sea under the Barcelona Convention. These species include hammerheads, tope, shortfin makos, and have declined dramatically in numbers, some by as much as 99% during the last century. Wow, I would have hated to have swam in the Mediterranean Sea 100 years ago, while others have vanished from parts of the Mediterranean where they once were common. The California Senate designated the endangered Pacific leatherback sea turtle as California's official state marine reptile and declare October 15th every year as Leatherback Conservation Day. Oceania was a sponsor and supporter of the bill and generated statewide support from thousands of California citizens and more than 30 conservative entities, including the California Fish and Game Commission. The bill is intended to recognize the importance of California state waters and to the survival and recovery of this ancient sea turtle species. Now, there are perhaps a dozen cases here, and this is exactly the way any agency government would work. It's the way our agency government works for 80 years. Since Roosevelt was president and these agencies were put in place, this is called litigious legislation. It means using the litigation system, the courts, to establish precedent to force legislation into place. In each one of these cases where Oceania was a sponsor and a supporter of the bill, it was because they had filed lawsuits in court and they had threatened the state with millions and millions of dollars in fines through the court system that the bill was even drafted and written. It's the way our agency government works. It's how the shadow government took control of everything in this country. They control the Environmental Protectionist Agency. They control the Department of Education. They control the Department of Commerce. They control every single department, agency, bureau, and administration the same way. First, they start with easy cases to win. First one, and then another, in very careful order, so that they can stack the precedents one on top of the other. And through this process, they can form legal cases to push all the way to the Supreme Court, as you saw in the Chilean rejection of the Castilla power plant. For the first time in its 60-year history, the FAO's General Fisheries Commission for the Mediterranean took action for shark protection. Why? The commission adopted measures for the management and conservation of sharks and rays in the Mediterranean, the region of highest risk in the world for these fishes. 23 Mediterranean counties endorsed a proposal from the EU that bans the unsustainable practice of shark finning. This is where they catch a shark, cut one fin off, and then release it back. The shark fins are, well, they're supposed to cause erections for 4 hours. What can I say? Prohibits trawling in some sensitive near-shore habitats and requires countries to collect and report data on catches of some threatened species. We call this bycatching. You go out to catch, snappers, and you end up catching a couple of dolphins and a pilot whale. You have to report the dolphins and the pilot whale. They'll be killed because they suffocate in the net. They become confused. Their sonar doesn't work. They're surrounded by so many fish, and they also can't, get to the surface to catch a breath. So they end up being killed. We call this bycatching. After campaigning by Oceana, the National Marine Fisheries Service announced new regulations for the Atlantic scallop fishery that will require turtle deflector devices in areas and during times when sea turtles are known to be present. The scallop fishery has long been a threat to sea turtles, who get caught up and drown in the heavy equipment. TDDs, these are turtle deflector devices, are expected to reduce sea turtle mortality by at least 56% when compared to former dredges that forced them into heavy chain bags where they were dragged and often drowned. All these are wonderful ideas, but what does campaigning by Oceana mean exactly? They don't really talk about their tactics, but I can tell you what they are. They're economic. The Chilean government announced its intention to expand the Salas y Gomez Marine Reserve and to create a smaller reserve off the coast of Easter Island. The government also announced a plan to develop an assessment and status report of the main fisheries of Easter Island. The announcement follows several expeditions to the islands and years of campaigning by Oceana. I guess they're reporting on the effects of fishing in that area. Another one, the California Senate Committee on Health took a key step forward to combat rampant seafood fraud occurring in the Golden State by passing SB 1486, a seafood labeling bill with important ramifications for human health, environmental sustainability, and consumer protection. Oceana applauds the Senate Health Committee for taking a leadership role in confronting the appalling level of seafood fraud in California. Earth Explorers, I can go through 30 cases like this where Oceana was involved in changes on this legislation. So I decided to go to Oceana and find out what they're all about. What did they do? Oceana's board of directors is a good place to start, don't you think? I venture to say no one has reported to you who their board of directors are, because all of the actions of the organization are being directed by the directors. It's their agenda. It's their way of, making sure these things are done right. So who are they? Who is the board of directors? Dr. Christian Parker, chair, Oak Philanthropy Limited. Parker was a member of Oceana's founding board of directors. He is a trustee of the Oak Foundation based in Switzerland and oversees Oak's environment program, Parker is also a marine biologist and received his PhD in environmental sciences from Duke University. Sounds innocuous enough. James Sandler, vice chair, the Sandler Foundation. By the way, I really want you to pay close attention that every one of these organizations is a nonprofit. That is to say, they are not supposed to lobby in government. If you do, you lose your nonprofit. But it also means that you can make tons of money and you can hide a myriad of assets that are owned by the foundation but are used by you. One of the worst offenders, and I'm sure you've seen their logo around on various websites, the worst offenders and has been cited numerous times for funneling money to terrorist organizations is the World Wildlife Organization. You know, the one with the panda. All right. The Sandler Foundation. Sandler was a member of Oceana's founding board of directors and is in charge of the Sandler Foundation's environmental giving. That's it. That's all it says. Valerie Van Cleve, treasurer, ocean advocate. Van Cleve's business career encompasses work in mergers and acquisitions, sales and marketing, and new business development. She has spearheaded successful fundraising efforts for political campaigns and conservation advocacy. She co-founds and co-chairs Sea Change, a record-breaking benefit for Oceana. So, when we're talking about mergers and acquisitions, we're talking about shell corporations. This is where a small amount of assets are merged with an existing publicly traded shell. That corporation then releases stock to the market, which is sold to investors. That money's raised and then spent without having to be repaid because it's not a loan, it's an investment, right? Well, if you do this numerous times, you can stack the assets between numerous corporations so that they all end up being funneled into one final account, which, of course, is under the control of the owner or founder or manager or managing director of all these corporations. The problem is that you have sometimes a dozen different checkbooks that this money will go through, and it's an auditing nightmare. It's almost impossible to find where the money goes. That's why these people do what they do. All right, Simon Sidemon Aristoff, secretary. Kalbian Haggerty, LLP. Sidemon Aristoff is a lawyer with the tax-exempt organizations group at Kalbian Haggerty, LLP in Washington, D.C. There's your lobbyist connection right there. You have to have a tax-exempt lawyer for all of your nonprofits in D.C. so that you can make all the phone calls, connections, and make sure that everything meets and goes through all of the agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations it's supposed to go. Keith Addis, president. Industry Entertainment Partners. If you've been to the website or you go to the website while you're listening to this program or after you listen to this program, you will be impressed. It's a marvelous website. The videos, the pictures, the photography, the layouts that they've done in these beautiful, pristine nature areas really will gloss your eyes over and say, oh, yes, this is a wonderful thing, and you may even want to donate. Well, this is where it comes from. You got to have somebody that puts the sizzle in the investment. Addis is the co-founder of Industry Entertainment, a leading management and production company. He is also a longtime environmentalist. Prior to joining Oceana's board, Addis was the chairman of the American Oceans Campaign. Under his leadership, AOC, founded by Addis's longtime friend and client, Ted Danson, you remember him, don't you? Cheers, achieved victories on key marine issues, including bottom trawling and offshore oil drilling. AOC merged with Oceana in 2001. There you go. There's one of the mergers that I'm talking about. Keep in mind that when they say victories on key marine issues, we're talking about litigation. This is the litigious legislation I was talking about. Herbert M. Bidulph III, Marisla Foundation. Bedolfi, the executive director of the Marisla Foundation, was one of Oceana's founders and led the organization from 2002 until 2008. Ricardo Cisneros, Cisneros Corporation. Cisneros is chairman of Cisneros Corporation, one of the premier privately held media, entertainment, and consumer products organizations based in Latin America. Cisneros is committed to the welfare of the Pimon people of the Gran Sabana region of Venezuela through Fundación Wonken, which he created for that purpose. He is an avid scuba diver and photographer. Ted Danson, actor, activist. Danson is best known for his role on the TV show Cheers, but for those in the conservation movement, he is famous for his work as a passionate ocean advocate and Oceana spokesman. Danson helped create the American Oceans Campaign in 1987, which eventually became Oceana in 2001. In the last two decades, Ted has appeared in public service announcements appealing to donors and testifying to the government on the condition of our oceans. Sydney Davis, designer, activist. Now we get into where the money came from to get things started. Davis is a jeweler, a jewelry designer, and activist. She and her husband, Andrew, are advocates for numerous environmental and educational causes. Through their family foundations, they work to protect and improve the lives of children, a goal that cannot be achieved without safeguarding the world's oceans. Davis is on the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center Advisory Council at the University of Texas in Austin and is an active member of Oceana's Ocean Council. Cesar Gaviria, the OTAN Group. Gaviria served as the president of Colombia from 1990 to 1994 and as secretary general of the Organization of American States from 1994 to 2004. During his four-year presidential term, Colombia drafted a new, more democratic constitution. I think you also know what else comes from Colombia, but that's okay. Maria Eugenia Giron, the business leader. Giron joined Oceana's board of directors in 2006, shortly after her tenure as chief executive officer of Carrera y Carrera, Spain's top jewelry manufacturer and one of the world's leading luxury brands. Maria Eugenia is an active lecturer, teacher, and advisor at various universities and business schools. She brings to Oceana a vast knowledge of strategic planning, marketing, and public relations. In 2004, Maria Eugenia was nominated for Woman Executive of the Year by the Spanish Federation of Women CEOs and Professionals. Stephen P. McAllister, Cherrywood Development, LLC. McAllister is a successful developer. Stephen became executive director of Greenpeace Australia in 1989 and from 1990 to 1991. He was deputy executive director and campaign director of Greenpeace International at its headquarters in Amsterdam in 2005. McAllister donated the use of the Ranger catamaran to Oceana. Michael Northrup, Rockefeller Brothers Fund. Northrup is program director for the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, global and domestic sustainable development program, where he focuses on climate change, forest protection, and marine conservation. Northrup moonlights as a lecturer at Yale University, where he teaches a graduate course on environmental campaigns at the Forest and Environmental Studies School. Previous positions have included a stint as executive director of Ashoka, an international development organization that seeks and supports public service entrepreneurs working around the globe. I don't know if that raises any detectors for you. Certainly on their website, in the description of his activities, Michael Northrup and the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, doesn't raise any alarm bells, but the fact that the Rockefellers are involved in something that involves seizing control of the world's oceans, I think you can see the combination at the very least nefarious. Dr. Daniel Pauly, the University of British Columbia. Pauly is a renowned fisheries scientist. Since 1994, Pauly has been a professor of the Fisheries Center, University of British Columbia. He currently serves as the principal investigator of the Sea Around Us project at the Fisheries Center, where his global multi-year analysis of marine ecosystems has allowed him to reach startling and important conclusions, most critical among them that fish populations are declining rapidly all over the world. Susan Rockefeller, documentary filmmaker. Rockefeller is a documentary filmmaker whose award-winning films have appeared on HBO and PBS. Rockefeller also authored the groundbreaking Green at Work that helped usher environmentally friendly jobs into non-traditional arenas. She's also a designer of inspirational jewelry. She sits on the program committee of the Stone Barns for Sustainable Agriculture, the Global Leadership Council for NRDC, and the Audubon's Women in Conservation, and she's also the chairwoman of Oceania's Ocean Council. Heather Stevens, Waterloo Foundation. Stevens and her husband founded the Waterloo Foundation based in UK, which she now chairs. Waterloo's environmental efforts are focused on marine work and tropical forest conservation. The foundation has funded considerable work in the marine sector, including campaigns to combat illegal fishing in West Africa and to improve the fishing industry and marine life in the Pacific Coral Triangle. Just a couple more. Roger Van Vie, the Adesium Foundation. Roger Van Vie is chairman of Adesium Foundation. Adesium Foundation is a Dutch fund founded in 2005. It is a privately funded public benefit organization that provides financial support to charitable organizations in the Netherlands and worldwide. Notice that these are only charitable organizations that they support. No commercial efforts whatsoever. No small businesses that are trying to make innovative progress in these areas. Adesium Foundation aspires to a world in which people live in harmony with each other and with their environments. Since 2002, Mr. Van Vie has also been a director at Multifund, a private investment company. Sam Waterson is also an actor and an activist. Waterson is best known for his role as Jack McVoy on TV's Law and Order. Waterson grew up in New England, where he saw the effects of fisheries collapse on the life, or fisheries collapses on the life of seaside towns. So now you know who Agenda 21 is. You know who Oceania is. I'm going to get more on the ICLEA, LEI, so that you know who they are. And the interesting thing is that there are changes taking place all around the world, all in this litigious legislation destabilization process that is designed to usurp the elected officials and to even usurp the will of the people with another agenda that is forced upon them, making it either on a local level economically impossible to resist. That's why it's so easy to sue on a local level where governments don't have the money to fight long and protracted battles in court, nor do they like the press of being litigated in federal court for environmental infractions. And if you do that, small town by small town, city by city, and you just heard Austin, Texas pass this piece of legislation which lays the groundwork for other litigation and other legislations to be passed. It's an easier battle to win. It takes a long time, but at least you don't have to take on things at the federal level. By the time it gets to the federal level, there's nothing you can do about it because it's already passed on the city and the state level and the smaller country level, and it becomes a global thing. This is how you take over a world. So I'm going to leave that with you tonight. My phone number is 888-429-5471. We'll be here for about another 54 minutes. I'm going to go ahead and take a quick break, and then the final hour, we're going to talk about some changes that are happening in the next 30-something days in this country and are going to affect the lives of everyone within the range of listening of this program tonight. And if you're listening to it as an archive, maybe you can take some action. As you would put your plans together, as I close out this hour, I want you to think about food storage. I want you to think about how you're going to manage your money over the next 90 days. I told you, as a Christmas present, you want to do something for yourself. You want to do something for your kids and your grandkids, something that will last. I'm suggesting that you put that expensive electronic gift aside and you buy them something that they can definitely use, especially if times become disruptive. I suggest that you invest in food. Go to X Squared Radio, click on the banner at the very top. It says The Food Investor. My friends Scott Barzee and Danny Morris with The Food Investor out in Utah have developed a food process that does not require preservatives. Once this delicious food is prepared and packaged, it will last for 30 years in the package in which you receive it. So if times become disruptive, you lose your job, you lose your home, there's a tornado, an earthquake, a fire, a flood, don't be a burden on FEMA. Take care of yourself and do it in a delicious way. You don't have to eat that pasty peanut butter that they put in the MREs. For about the same money, you can get something very delicious that'll last a long time. Invest in food for them. Let's take a quick break. We'll listen to the girls sing Leonard Cohen's song, Hallelujah. Be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back, X Squared Radio. Here with you, I'm Brooks Agnew, your host, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast about 62 degrees and overcast. So glad you could be here with us tonight. We love sharing this information with you and keeping you informed about the things that are happening in our world. And, you know, there are some things that are happening in our local neighborhood that we want to take care of. A recent article that just came out with an interesting observation. You know, it was interesting, the perspective that came out in this article. The fact that Mitt Romney is about as close to defeating President Barack Obama as any Republican could have hoped to be. But it's interesting how the press is kind of treating him, in effect, like the president. After all, it was President Romney, not Obama, who set time aside to visit victims of Hurricane Isaac. It was President Romney, not Obama, who reacted swiftly to the attack on our embassies by standing up for American freedom. It was President Romney, not Obama, who took on the entitlements crisis head on by adopting many of Paul Ryan's ideas. It was President Romney, not Obama, who laid out a practical plan for the housing crisis. The media have also treated Romney as the incumbent, pouncing on every word and gesture, seizing on every mistake and inventing errors where none exist. Romney's so-called gaffes have one thing in common. They are all statements of fact. He is being held to a presidential standard, for presidents should know better than to tell all. While Obama's outright lies to the nation on Libya, the debt, you name it, are ignored by the media. Obama's failures as the actual incumbent are also passed over or spun into positives. We reached 2,000 dead in Afghanistan. Hey, Obama ended the war. Unemployment's still above 8%. Oh, that jobs report was better than expected. We were attacked by Al-Qaeda on 9/11 and Obama lied about it. Don't worry, Bin Laden is dead and General Motors is alive. Growth down to 1.3%? Say, no one could have done it better. The last canard came to us courtesy of former President Bill Clinton, who returned to the political scene to disown his own political legacy after Obama had spent the past 4 years destroying it and his entire political career fighting it. The expansion of the welfare state, the proliferation of opaque regulations, and the explosion of debt were all things Clinton resisted. No longer, not when 2016 may be a new opportunity for Hillary. Romney is also the incumbent in a cultural sense. He is the old, rich, white guy that 45 years of higher education in Hollywood have inveighed against. He has a stake in the system and values that two successive generations of elites have been taught to hate. And so an election that ought to have been a referendum on Obama, and which Obama hoped to turn into a chance between him and Romney, is now a referendum on Romney alone. The cost of losing is clear, or ought to be. The nation will face a fiscal cliff on January 1st, and Obama's plan, if he wins, is to force tax hikes that may cover some of the gap in the short term, but will hurt everyone in the long term through slow economic growth. A loss for Romney means Obamacare is forever. Though it has already cost American families $3,000 instead of the $2,500 in savings on health insurance premiums Obama promised. A Romney loss also means America will have accepted persistent high unemployment and slow growth as the new normal, creating a lost generation and destroying both our entitlement system and our future prosperity. It means Israel will likely be forced to go to war, and likely on its own against Iran. It means the Supreme Court will be liberal for at least a generation, as the far left fulfill its wish to transform our living constitution. So now you know what we're up against. Am I a Republican? No, not really. More libertarian than anything else, but I see the choice we have, and I'm being mature about it. Now, good news. The first audit results are in. The Federal Reserve's nearly 100-year history were posted today. Representative Ron Paul wins again. The most significant victory of his congressional career. He has taken his pet issue since the 1970s, the unwarranted power and secrecy of the Federal Reserve, from something pretty much no one but him cared about 6 years ago, through a best-selling book and mass movement by 2009, the second time he's gotten the House of Representatives to vote to widen the government's powers to audit the Fed's activities. It passed, and the audit is underway. The first ever General Accountability Office audit of the Federal Reserve was carried out in the past few months due to the Ron Paul, Alan Grayson amendments to the Dodd-Frank bill, which passed last year. Jim DeMint, a Republican senator, and Bernie Sanders, an independent senator, led the charge for a Federal Reserve audit in the Senate, but watered down the original language of the House bill so that a complete audit would not be carried out. Ben Bernanke, Alan Greenspan, and various other bankers vehemently opposed the audit and lied to Congress about the effects an audit would have on markets. Nevertheless, the results of the first audit in the Federal Reserve's nearly 100-year history were posted on Senator Sanders' website earlier this morning. What was revealed in the audit was nothing less than stunning. $16 trillion, if I'm doing this right, let's see, that's a million, that's a billion, yes, $16 trillion had been secretly given out to U.S. banks and corporations and foreign banks everywhere from France to Scotland from the period between December 2007 and June 2010. The Federal Reserve had secretly bailed out many of the world's banks, corporations, and governments. The Federal Reserve likes to refer to these secret bailouts as an all-inclusive loan program, but virtually none of the money has been returned, and it was loaned out at, guess what, 0% interest. Why the Federal Reserve had never been public about this or even informed the United States Congress about the $16 trillion bailout is obvious. The American people would have been outraged to find out that the Federal Reserve bailed out foreign banks while Americans were struggling to find jobs. To place $16 trillion into perspective, remember that the gross domestic product of the United States, the entire United States, is only $14.12 trillion. The entire national debt of the United States government, spanning its 200-plus year history, is only $14.5 trillion. The budget that is being debated so heavily in Congress and in the Senate is only $3.5 trillion. Take all of the outrage and debate over the $1.5 trillion deficit into consideration and swallow this red pill. There was no debate about whether $16 trillion would be given to failing banks and failing corporations around the world. There was never any intention to pay back a loan at 0% interest. Normally, as a normal course of business, banks will always make the financially worst decision possible. That's a rule of thumb. They won't loan to business that generates jobs and payroll and taxes to go back into the community, but they will loan to businesses who are already heavily in debt and who are on a surefire course of failure. Forget about small businesses that are on the grow. Loan your money to businesses that are at the peak of the mountain, headed for the canyon. In late 2008, the TARP bailout bill was passed, and loans of $800 billion were given to failing banks and companies. That was a blatant lie, considering the fact that Goldman Sachs alone received $814 billion. As it turns out, the Federal Reserve donated $2.5 trillion to Citigroup, while Morgan Stanley received $2 trillion. The Royal Bank of Scotland and Deutsche Bank and German Bank split about $1 trillion, and numerous other banks received hefty chunks of the $16 trillion. This is a clear case of socialism for the rich and rugged. You're on your own, individualism for everyone else. When you have conservative Republican stalwarts like Jim DeMint and Ron Paul, as well as self-identified Democrat socialists like Bernie Sanders, all fighting against the Federal Reserve, you know that it is no longer an issue of right versus left. When you have every single member of the Republican Party in Congress and progressive congressmen like Dennis Kucinich sponsoring a bill to audit the Federal Reserve, I mean, this was overwhelmingly passed by Congress. You realize that the Federal Reserve is an entity unto itself, which has no oversight and no accountability. Americans should be swelled with anger and outrage at the abysmal state of affairs when an unelected group of bankers can create money out of thin air and then give it out to mega banks and super corporations like Halloween candy at 0% interest. And, oh, by the way, there's no term on this loan either. That means there's no payment schedule. Yeah, pay it when you get it. It's sort of like a dad loaning money to his son to buy a car. You'll give it back to me when I'm old, son. It's okay. You don't need to pay me back. What does that teach the son? Exactly the wrong thing. If the Federal Reserve and the bankers who control it believe that they can continue to devalue the savings of Americans and continue to destroy the U.S. economy, they will have to face the realization that their trillion-dollar printing presses will eventually plunder the world economy. Of course, they'll be dead and gone by then, right? So who's worrying about it? Well, I'm going to name for you now the list of institutions that received the most money from the Federal Reserve. See if your organization is on the list. Citigroup, $2.5 trillion. By the way, Citigroup is one of the biggest naked short traders out there. They're being sued for $400 million by Overstock.com for naked shorting their stock. I would encourage any other small business who sees stock show up on the exchange that they didn't issue, join that lawsuit. Make it a class action lawsuit. Put 6,000, put 18,000, put 50,000 corporations on that list, suing Citigroup for destroying their corporations in the name of absolute profit. Morgan Stanley, $2 trillion. Merrill Lynch, $2 trillion. Bank of America, $1.3 trillion. Barclays Bank, $868 billion. Bear Stearns, $853 billion. Goldman Sachs, $814 billion. By the way, they also dumped 94% of their stock in Deep Horizon. You remember the oil rig that blew up in the Gulf of Mexico? Just a couple of weeks before it happened, by the way, after doubling the insurance on the rig. Royal Bank of Scotland, $541 billion. J.P. Morgan Chase, $391 billion. Deutsche Bank, $354 billion. UBS Switzerland, $287 billion. By the way, if you're a small business and you apply for a loan from any one of these banks, forget about it. Credit Suisse, $262 billion. I know this one by experience. Lehman Brothers, $183 billion. Bank of Scotland, UK, $181 billion. And BNP Paribas France, $175 billion. And there are many, many more, including banks in Belgium, of all places. So you can go look at it for yourself. It's a 266-page GAO audit of the Federal Reserve. And I know what you're saying. So what? So what? $16 trillion printing press just running out a bunch of ones and zeros of imaginary money, our money, your money, right out of your savings account. You lost $4,000 of your own earning power, your own buying power, last year alone, just from the efforts of the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, who is Barack Obama's appointee, participated in a live webcast of a town hall meeting with educators on Thursday. That was September 30th, 2010. During this session, Chairman Bernanke answered teachers' questions about Federal Reserve and the economy. And you should go and listen to that, but I'm not going to cover that because I only got about 20 minutes left, and I want to cover a couple other things. There's a story out there about zombies. No, not like Zombieland. I mean like bees, honeybees. The infection is as grim as it sounds, zombie bees. They have a parasite that causes them to fly at night and lurch around erratically until they die. And experts say the condition has crept into Washington State. That could be incredibly bad. Washington State needs those bees to pollinate their crops. This is Mark Hone, a novice beekeeper. I joke with my kids that the zombie apocalypse is starting at my house. Hone returned from a vacation a few weeks ago to find many of his bees either dead or flying in jerky patterns and then flopping on the floor. He remembered hearing about zombie bees, so he collected some of the corpses and popped them into a plastic bag. About a week later, the Kent man had evidence his bees were infected, the pupa of parasitic flies. Curiosity got the better of me, Hone said. The zombie bees were first to be confirmed in Washington State, the Seattle Times reported. The San Francisco State University biologist John Hafernick first discovered zombie bees in California in 2008. Hafernick now uses a website to recruit citizen scientists like Hone to track the infection across the country. What happens is the pupa end up consuming the bee from the inside out, affects them and causes them to behave erratically. Also, an interesting study that came out wanted to know if life on other planets originated from Earth. You know, you've heard of the theory called transpermia, right? I mean, lots of people have talked about it. Linda Moulton Howe talked about it the other day on Coast to Coast. In the opening scene of Ridley Scott's Prometheus, you remember seeing that movie, right? Before there were any real lines, there was an alien engineer, and he's seen seeding the earth with life. He eats, you know, those microbes, and then they dissolve his body, and he falls into the sea, and that's where life began, and evidently that's why we track them back to the planet, the beginning of the movie Aliens. It would now appear, however, that the film got this backwards. A newly discovered gravitational process called weak transfer indicates that the Earth was once capable of sending slow-moving, microbe-carrying rocks out of the solar system. As a result, astrobiologists are now wondering if our planet has spawned life elsewhere. Proponents of the panspermia hypothesis have spent most of their time trying to understand how an incoming object may have given rise to life on Earth. The basic idea is that a microbe-laden meteorite landed here billions of years ago, resulting in a kind of extraterrestrial genesis. A fundamental problem with this theory, however, is that such a meteorite could make the journey from a neighboring solar system. According to lithopanspermia theory, microorganisms may have been ejected into space after a planet suffered a cataclysmic impact with an asteroid or by virtue of a powerful volcanic eruption, sort of spitting it out into space like a bullet. Most scientists don't contest this possibility, but what the pre-existing models have shown is that it is an excruciatingly rare microbe-laden ejecta to escape the gravity well of a solar system. But according to researchers from Princeton University, the University of Arizona, and the Centro de Astrobiología in Spain, a special set of cosmological circumstances can exist in which a slow, small rocky object can easily escape the gravitational pull of its parent star. By factoring realistic velocities down to 50 times slower than previous estimates, it's about 100 meters per second. It's about as fast as a baseball pitcher throws a baseball. And by taking the presence of other large and nearby bodies into account, such as gas giants, the researchers were able to illustrate the effect of weak transfer. This is kind of a slingshot theory. We've used it with our own satellites. In such a scenario, a slow-moving planetary fragment wanders into the outer edge of a planet's gravitational pull, called the weak stability boundary. Because the planet only has a loose grip on the meteor, it can escape and be propelled back into space, drifting until it is pulled by another planetary system, including one that's in a completely different solar system. All this said, the planetary configurations required for such interstellar journey are extremely small. The research indicates that the only time in history when this weak transfer was possible was between 164 million to 288 million years after the formation of the solar system. This was a special time in which our solar system's history, when our sun was still part of its birth cluster. According to the researcher, Amayamoto Martin, it should be Martin, there are two fundamental requirements for weak transfer. First, the planetary systems involved must contain a massive planet that captures the passing meteor in the weak gravity boundary that would be Jupiter. And second, both systems must have low relative velocities, or our sun's cluster consisted of between 1,000 to 10,000 gravitational bound stars for hundreds of millions of years. The Earth passes both of these tests. To prove the viability of their models, the researchers simulated 5 million trajectories between single star planetary systems in a cluster with about 4,300 stars and under three different conditions. The resulting data show that the odds of a star capturing a fragment from another planetary system under these primordial circumstances ranged from 5 to 15%. Now, that's a huge contrast to previous estimates indicating it would literally be a billion times more unlikely. Not so. And amazingly, that means approximately a little better than 1 out of 10 times, okay? 1 out of 6 times such an asteroid would be captured. And amazingly, the researchers also calculated the amount of solid matter that could have been exchanged between our solar system and our nearest neighbor or another neighbor. They came up with a figure ranging from 100 trillion to 300 quadrillion fragments weighing more than 10 kilograms. That's about 22.5 pounds. Their calculations revealed that some 200 billion rocks from Earth could have been flung away to another star system, rocks that could have contained microbes. In total, the researchers speculate that roughly 300 million lithopanspermia events could have occurred between our solar system and our closest planetary neighbor. How about that? But, gotta ask the question, did life exist on Earth that long ago? This is where the researcher's theory gets a bit tenuous, but it's not a ridiculous stretch to suggest that primitive life was in fact present as much as 3.8 billion years ago. Water was already here on the Earth at this stage in its geologic history, and the first microorganisms did in fact start to appear shortly after this time, about 3.5 billion years ago. And mind-blowingly enough, the weak transfer window was already open for Earth at this exact time when it was too able to receive interstellar fragments. Our planet may very well have been seeded at this time. As for the journey through space, astrobiologists generally believe that microbes can survive exposure to harsh conditions and long enough to make a journey requiring tens of millions of years. So assuming that life did exist on Earth at this time, there was indeed a period of about 400 million years when life could have traveled much more easily to other habitable worlds and vice versa. Now, it's not so crazy. Here's the abstract of the official paper. Now, the paper is in a publication that's 766 pages long. Obviously, I couldn't read that to you tonight, but I will read you the abstract. We examined, and there's an abstract, and then I added a paragraph to the end of it, and I'll let you know when that begins. We examined a low-energy mechanism for the transfer of meteoroids between two planetary systems embedded in a star cluster using quasi-parabolic orbits of minimal energy. Using Monte Carlo simulations, we found that the exchange of meteoroids could have been significantly more efficient than previously estimated. Our study is relevant to astrobiology as it addresses whether life on Earth could have been transferred to other planetary systems in the solar system's birth cluster, and whether life on Earth could have been transferred from beyond the solar system. In the solar system, the time scale over which solid material was delivered to the region from where it could be transferred via this mechanism likely extended to several hundred million years. That's a pretty good size window, I would say. This time scale could have overlapped with the lifetime of the solar birth cluster. Therefore, we conclude that lithopanspermia is an open possibility if life had an early start. Adopting parameters from the minimum mass solar nebula, considering a range of plantissimal size distributions derived from observations of asteroids and Kuiper belt objects and theoretical coagulation models, and taking into account Oort cloud formation models — this is where we get comets from — we discerned that the expected number of bodies with mass greater than 10 kilograms, that's 22.5 pounds, that could have been transferred between the sun and its nearest cluster neighbor could be of the order of 10 to the 14th to 3 times 10 to the 16th. That's a high probability. With transfer time scales of tens of millions of years, we estimate that the order of 3 times 10 to the 8th, that's about 300 million, could potentially be life-bearing. Where is the depth of Earth's crust in kilometers that was ejected as a result of the early bombardment? And this is where asteroids would have struck Earth and caused a kind of explosion out into space of pieces of sea floor or dry land that may have held complex life. Now, this is what I added. It can be further assumed with scientific confidence that inasmuch as we Earthlings are considering and will yet complete a mission to Mars, that we will unavoidably transfer microbes and perhaps larger organisms to Mars, and that if we are about to do it to them, this most likely has already been done to our planet. To assume that we are the first life forms to have traveled to another planet is not logical. It can be reasoned with support that Earth is far more of an attractive planet to any sentient being in a craft that might happen to be exploring our solar system than any other planet. It is well known among the most casual astronaut that a planet with liquid water is the most likely to be populated or to accept the seeding of life. So just in case you were thinking you had to rely on 10 to the 16th chances over a 100 million year period that a piece of rock 22.5 pounds could be thrown off of this planet, travel several light years through space, land on another planet, and thus reconstitute in the water and sunshine of that planet and create life on that planet, it's just as likely, given the fact that we've already put several human beings into aluminum cans and taken them to other planets in our solar system, that other organizations, other civilizations, and other solar systems have done the same thing and may, quite likely, have been much more successful than we have been at doing it. In other words, they've gone further and faster. And if they're in our neighborhood out here on the edge of the Milky Way galaxy with main sequence suns, what's more cool than Earth to visit? Especially when you got 4.5 billion years to do it. Now, just in the last couple of minutes here, I want to make sure that you know that I'm not standing alone when I'm telling you to move your disposable cash out of the bank and into your own hands and to invest in hard metal silver. Don't invest in that paper and let someone else hold on to your silver. That's not too bright, if you know what I mean. Go ahead and buy the silver bars and keep them in your possession. You can bury them in a mason jar. You can put them in a safe. I recommend the small ones. Recently, there's an Islamist group that warns of new cyber attacks on U.S. banks. It happened this last week. I saw the results of it myself. An Islamic group this last week said it will carry out new cyber attacks on U.S. banking targets, according to Site Intelligence Group. They attacked Wells Fargo Bank, and within hours of the attack, I bank with Wells Fargo. My access to my account was greatly slowed. It took up to 10 minutes for my account to come up. Now, no money was turned up missing, but deposits went in very, very slowly. In a statement, a group of hackers calling themselves the Cyber Fighters of Izz al-Din al-Qassam said they plan to attack the websites of Wells Fargo Bank on Tuesday, that of U.S. Bank on Wednesday, and that of PNC Bank on Thursday. Wednesday, Wells Fargo portals were brought to a near standstill across the web. Millions of depositors were denied speedy access to their accounts online. Direct deposits were delayed, and thousands of man hours were spent trying to make sure accounts remained intact. The FBI is hunting them click by click through cyberspace to find the perpetrators. When the buck stops, the arrests will be made. But the trail has been set. The fact that they could get in and make these changes is what's frightening. That's what we're seeing. Operation Ababil began with Bank of America. The second stage was the attack on the biggest bank of the United States, Chase. This series of attacks will continue until the heinous film disappears from the internet. The truth is, this is all about the money. Remember Hans Gruber in Die Hard 1 when he demanded to free all the terrorist brothers held around the world? Yeah, it distracted law enforcement while they stole the bearer bonds. Same thing. And this is nothing more. That film had nothing to do with anything. So it's all smoke and mirrors put out by them. We're out of time. Sorry we got started late tonight. Next week I will be at the Conscious Life Expo. I may or may not do a presentation from there. But relax, take it easy, have a productive week. Don't work too hard, but make lots of money. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. Remember to find the good in others and help it to grow a little every day. Because if you do, you may end up saving the planet. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.